Welcome to the latest podcast by the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. My name is Luca Pieri, and today's podcast discusses migrant community organizing in crisis situations, focusing on the case of Latin Americans in London during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're glad to be joined by two of our researchers, Domiziana Turcatti, Senior Social Researcher here at the National Institute. Hi, Domiziana.
Hi, Luca. Thank you.
And Jasmine Rostron, Associate Social Researcher. Thank you, Jasmine, for being with us.
Thank you, Luca.
Both of our researchers have conducted extensive migration research, but I'm very delighted, and we are all very delighted, to be joined also by three leaders in the Latin American community in London with whom our researchers work with. Ms. Claudia Lopez, a Colombian English teacher in secondary school in London. Welcome to this podcast, Claudia.
Hello. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me.
And then we have Bruna Buscaini, the director of IRMO, the Indo-American Refugee Migrant Organization, a London charity supporting and advocating for the rights of Latin American migrants in London and in the whole of the UK. Thank you for being with us, Bruna, today.
Thank you, Luca. Lovely to be here.
And Lucia Filinic, the Health and Wellbeing Project Lead at IRMO. Thank you, Lucia, for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
So let's crack on. Domiziana, you have been involved in various projects exploring the role of non-government organizations, NGOs, the role that they play in the migrants' lives before and during COVID-19. Can you tell us, you know, what migrant community organizing is and why do we need to talk about this now in post-COVID context?
Thank you, Luca. Well, community organizing is really about bringing people together to take action around common concerns, overcome social injustice. And these can be done in many ways, through grassroots campaigns, advocacy efforts, or by establishing and running charities. And migrants very much lead on community organizing. As you mentioned, part of my research has been on the role of migrant-led NGOs. And I've learned that really migrant-led NGOs play a really important role in countries such as the UK. They have a liberal welfare models. We know that in the UK since the 80s, the UK has adopted liberal policies that have been shifting responsibility for service provision to the market, individuals and communities that now deliver several services to those most in need on behalf of the state. Now, there are many studies on this, and they discuss how NGOs support migrants, refugees and other newcomers by providing basic services, capacity and skill development, including English courses or through advocacy. But many of these studies, they don't often recognize that first, migrants support these organizations by volunteering or working for them. And secondly, that some of these organizations are actually established and led by migrants themselves. And the UK has a really long history of migrant community organizing dating back to the 50s. And today we have IRMO, which grew out of one of the first Latin American community organizations and campaigns in the UK, established in 1982. And that is 40 years ago. So why do we need to recognize migrant community organizing? I see two main reasons, if you want. One is more conceptual, the other one has more policy implications. If we don't recognize how migrants lead on community organizing efforts, we perpetuate the idea of migrants as victims rather than agents in their communities. But secondly, we know charities and migrant-led campaigning led by migrants or other ethnic minorities are facing many challenges today in this financial crisis context. So this speaks more to policy and what we can do to support this effort. So that brings me to the second part of your question, Luca, which was, why do we need to talk about this now, post-COVID?
Yeah.
Jasmine and I worked and found that Latin American charities and community leaders play a key role during the pandemic. But while the pandemic is over, its effects are not. And we have the cost of living crisis exacerbating that. So we just need to keep learning about what migrant leaders and communities are doing and think together in terms of what research and policy is needed to continue support their effort.
Thank you, Domiziana. So, Jasmine, you are a health and migration researcher here at the Institute, but also a member of the Latin American community yourself in London. So why is community organizing particularly important for the American community, as, you know, for your personal experience and obviously from a research point of view that you have carried out in the recent past?
Thank you, Luca. Absolutely. I think it's important first to start with a bit of context of the Latin American population. So looking in the UK, they are one of the fastest growing migrant and ethnic groups, and particularly in London. There was a recent study by Professor Catherine McIlwain at King's College London, which estimated that between 2001 and 2021, the Latin American population increased by 406% in London and 395% in England and Wales. They are a huge population who is increasing in size, and it's very important to understand what their needs are. But despite their size and growing population, they have been called by many scholars an invisible population, an invisible community. And this stems from the fact that Latin Americans are not officially recognized by the British Ethnic Recognition Scheme. Therefore, their voices, their priorities are not systematically captured, for example, by the ONS census, nor in NHS registration or any health data collected by the state. There has been a lot of work done by Latin American charities and activists to bring attention to the need of migrants. And through this, four London boroughs and the Greater London Authority do recognize Latin Americans as an ethnic group, but this recognition is not yet universal. We're also looking at the wider context, as Domitiana said, looking at a neoliberal state, especially in a context with hostile government policies towards migrants. Government is not also here particularly looking at Latin Americans' needs. There is a need here for communities to organize to provide services and act as a bridge between Latin Americans and government services, because no one else would do it for them.
So why the Latin American migrant community is not officially recognized by the British Ethnic Recognition Scheme? Is that the only foreign community, like not, or the other ethnic community not recognized officially?
There are many reasons given. Like maybe you could all speak to it too, but from what I understand is to create recognition, you need to also establish need beforehand. And at the moment, the populations that are listed and are ethnically recognized are the ones which the UK recognizes as the biggest ones, or the biggest ones in need. Historically, there are also ones that have been populations of previous colonial countries in the UK, so maybe that is also why they receive more recognition. But if you have any more thoughts on this.
Well, I mean, yes, lots of thoughts. And it all stems down to data. I think that we are an emerging ethnicity. So we have been here for quite a long time, but I would say, you know, past generations, as immigrants do when they arrive to the country, it's to survive. They need to survive. They need to establish a home, routines for their children, work. Yes. Their priorities has not been recognized. They are here for survival. And I think as the years have gone by, and now we've got, you know, first, second, and possibly third generations of Latin Americans, now we're sort of standing up and thinking, hey, why are other ethnicities recognized and we're not? You know, we're here and we deserve that recognition. And I think it all comes from us as a community, because we can't expect the government just to say, hey, yes, fabulous Latin American, we're going to recognize you now. So it's all down to us and leading these sorts of campaigns and speaking up in the community about why it's important, and almost educating our community, you know, from the past, you know, parents and grandparents who possibly were here, who were simply here to survive and to, you know, sow their roots, to now their children and their grandchildren who are looking around and thinking, why are we not taken seriously?
Yes.
Yeah. I think if I may, an additional point is that sometimes we would hear that it's necessary to have data on that community to justify the inclusion. It's very difficult to gather the data because you're not recognized. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky position to be in as well. Mm-hmm. And then it relies a lot on groups and community-led organizations to put that case forward.
It's definitely an interesting point, because, you know, probably many of our listeners maybe are not aware that there is such a thing like the British Ethnic Recognition Scheme. So thank you for bringing it up, because I think it was very interesting. So my next question is obviously for you, our three guests for today. You as community leaders, understand you have collaborated with our research in different capacity and different timelines, but understand the impact of COVID-19 on American migrants in London. Can you tell us a bit more about how you have mobilized to support Latin American migrants, their families and children during COVID-19? So maybe whoever wants to tackle this first in terms of practical steps or, you know, any kind of other initiative that has been taken.
Well, I think I came from quite a unique position, being a teacher in a secondary school in Lambeth, where, you know, we have a huge Latin American population. And the school is in itself in quite a unique position, where about 27% of the school is Latin American, which is
quite a lot.
Quite a lot, yes. So, you know, let's think a quarter of the school is Latin American, which isn't really seen, I think, in other schools around, especially the borough of Lambeth and Southwark. So our priority, first of all, was to tackle the language barrier. I've got students who were born here, students that their parents have been here for many, many years, but yet there still is that language barrier. So as a school, it was breaking down the language barrier and making sure that our families understood everything that was going on. Because, you know, as migrant families do, they're watching the news from back home. It could be Colombia, Ecuador, and they're seeing everything that was put in place back there and thinking the same was happening here. So it's ensuring that our families knew exactly sort of what was happening in the UK, specifically in London. The second point was children from one day to another. I remember the date, the 20th of March, being said, okay, that's it, yeah, you're going to stay home.
We all remember.
Yeah, many of our migrant families live in shared accommodation, very small accommodation. We went from one day, you know, them having, you know, they could get their breakfast and lunch at school, possibly sometimes free, to then having to home study at school and have a laptop, a tablet, which many of them did not have.
You think the language barrier exacerbated these problems at home
the anxiety and many of the students of the school, their parents are key workers, because I mean London still has to be cleaned. The hospitals, I had a number of families where the parents worked at St Thomas's Hospital. So the fear of the children knowing that their parents were going into the setting where it was really kicking off, having to get the train, having to get the bus, then being alone all day in
Online. Yeah.
You know, there's a family of four. How were four children meant to have laptops? So then that was another issue tackled. That was sort of my role within the school, along with Citizens UK, where we campaigned for migrant children to be able to get Chromebooks, laptops, tablets, because the government was obviously the children who are in social care and free school meals children, but migrants don't actually tend to fall into those categories. Their parents are still working. So if you think about it, most migrant children don't even get free school meals because their parents work. But due to the cost of living, doesn't actually mean that parents can afford to put food on the table or go out and buy them a laptop. So I campaigned along with Citizens UK to get students laptops. We had a fantastic guy who sort of, I went around during the pandemic collecting laptop and Chromebooks from people who donated them. We set up a GoFundMe page and we were able to buy over 150 Chromebooks and able to sort of start sharing them out among families. Another thing that I was able to do, lucky enough to do in the position, was speak to Lambeth Council to get COVID information translated into Spanish, because I mean Spanish is a second most spoken language in Lambeth, but yet the COVID information was translated into, had a meeting obviously, was in English, French, Somali and Portuguese. I took the moment, I was in a meeting with someone from Lambeth Council and I said, hey, why is there nothing in Spanish? Oh, I didn't think about that. Well, I mean, we really should think about these sort of things. And they said, okay, within 24 hours we're going to have COVID information translated into Spanish. I thought, okay, here we go, let's wait and see, because I know even more uncertain challenge have been asking for this for years. I was surprised 12 hours later they sent me a draft of information
translated into Spanish.
The language barrier was, you know, it's one of the things that forced these families into uncertainty and anxiety, both the parents as well as the children. And often, many times, children are the translators, and having to translate all this information to their parents is hard.
Well, I think so much of what you just said, Claudia, resonates to what we saw at Irmo as well. I would perhaps highlight the first action that we had to take was move all our delivery to remote delivery. Yeah. That was extremely challenging as a community organization that is really used to having our doors open so anyone can simply walk in and ask a question.
They rely on the physical interaction and presence as a way of also probably, you know.
And it's amazing our service so accessible to so many Latin Americans as well, because if someone would struggle to get in touch with us by email or calling IRMU, they could simply show up and they would receive the information that they needed. So closing our doors was quite dramatic, I would say, for a community organization that had been around for almost 40 years at that time. Our anniversary was around COVID. Yeah. So that was the first thing, and ensure that the team had all the resources that they need to be able to continue to support the community. Similar to what Ms. Lopez was saying just now, we also translated a lot of resources. We have been able to collaborate with Lambeth Council as well, sometimes amending some of those translations to make sure that they could speak to the community in a way that it would be really understood, because I think there is also that element with translation and interpreting that it can be more or less culturally sensitive. And it was key to be able to do that. We also set up on our website at FAQ about COVID in Spanish and Portuguese, and that covers several topics that became so, well, they have always been important, but they became urgent at that time. So employment, also welfare benefits, housing, and so on. And I think that was key to make sure that the population was properly informed. Beyond that, we also increased our capacity because we saw that more and more people were in need of advice, for example. So we have increased our welfare advice service, our housing advice service, and really tailor that to the crisis that we were tackling and to the needs that were emerging from that. We have also set up a specific project to support those with no recourse to public funds. And we noticed naturally that with COVID, that population was even more vulnerable than those that could access public funds naturally. It's very challenging to support them because of all the limitations that the system imposed on us. But I feel that we've been able to do quite a lot, and that it was really good that IDMO was able to expand that delivery around COVID time. We also move our activities with children and people to like remote activities. Surprisingly, we had good engagement, so we've been able to continue to support children with mentoring sessions and so on. We also connected with other organizations that were doing a lot in terms of providing IT equipment, because that became essential. And while I think those are some of the things that we managed to do, I would highlight one last element, that is the advocacy work that was done by IDMO as well. Very similar to what Claudia just shared with us. So really communicating to the local authority the needs of Latin Americans, the needs of those that speak Spanish and Portuguese, so that not only materials would be created so everyone was informed, but that more could then be done when we got to the point of the vaccine. And that was successful. That's what led us to then be able to set up a proper project at IRMU. And this is the moment that I would pass it to Lucia, because we divided in a way that she can bring a bit of her experience as frontline in the moment that we already had the vaccine and our engagement changed a bit.
So as Bruna mentioned, June 2021, IMO started with what it was then, the COVID and well-being project, that then changed to health and well-being project. So this is when I started as a staff member before being a volunteer. And so the aim of the project was to facilitate access to the COVID vaccine to the Latin American community. And we did this by doing outreach work. So our outreach work focused mainly in Lambeth and SADC, but also online, because and one of the good things that came after the pandemic is that IRMO started to connect with service users from outside London, because many services still remain with the online option, like advice. So something good came out of this after all. So this the COVID and well-being project started in collaboration with Lambeth Council. So as part of the project, we work with other Lambeth organizations like HUK and also the Lambeth Well-being Bus. This was in the beginning a pop-up clinic to access the COVID vaccine for Lambeth residents. And then it changed their service offers to other health topics. So my colleague and I used to go to the Well-being Bus to provide interpreting services to people to get vaccinated. And also we promoted, as this was a safe place for people to ask questions about the vaccine and also to be able to get vaccinated, for example, newcomers or people who were not in the system or thought they could not get vaccinated because they were not British or because they haven't been here for a long time. We received many, many people coming even from outside of the borders just to get vaccinated with us in the pop-up clinic because they could speak their language. After the Lambeth project, we also included another project with SADC Council, and it was going to pop-up clinics in SADC and to a pharmacy to provide also interpreting services. As this project grew, other things that we already knew, but it was like the pandemic highlighted many like vulnerabilities of people. And for example, that many people were not registered with a GP. And so because of this, for example, they could not get their COVID records because they couldn't download the NHS app. And many, besides traveling, some, because as Claudia mentioned, many of the families are frontline workers, so they were asking for these vaccination records from work. So we started to increase our services to GP registration, also supporting people book appointments if they couldn't speak English on the phone or they couldn't use the app. Nowadays, we do other things like refer us to mental health services, promote children vaccination, cancer screening. So we grew a lot from 2021.
That's great. Actually, yeah, I have a follow-up question. You know, many interesting things you have said, all of you. But Bruna, you mentioned the limitations that the system imposed on you. If you can just briefly expand on this, I think it would be helpful because I'm not sure that many listeners are probably aware of those.
Of course. So I was referring specifically to those that have no recourse to public funds. Mm-hmm. So these are people that wouldn't, in their regular lives, wouldn't be able to apply for benefits, housing support, and so on. That's the specific approach, let's say, the immigration system has in the UK. And that's something that is challenged by many community organizations and those in the migration field. So in the moment that we had COVID as this huge emergency in front of us, we also had many people that before were able to work and therefore they were able to cover their living costs, suddenly facing a situation where they might have lost their jobs. They wouldn't be able to work from home. We know that most of the workers that we support wouldn't. And then we as an organization that would support them end up quite limited. We are not able to apply for welfare benefits. We're not able to support them accessing housing. And we end up limited to having to rely on emergency funds and very short-term measures. So that was very challenging. I think it just showed how this issue in a context of a crisis becomes really incredibly big to manage.
Yeah, thank you, Bruno. I think you hinted about the main challenges that you encountered in supporting Latin Americans during the pandemic. One curiosity I have is how you try to make sure that no one was sort of left behind, in the sense that obviously not every single Latin American is aware of, probably Irmo is aware of other organization in, you know, locally. So how you try to make sure that you reach everyone and each of them. And also probably one of the things that worked best is word of mouth. The old word of mouth, even in a digital age.
What?
Yeah, the WhatsApp word of mouth. I think it probably one thing that came to my mind. I'm not sure if that was the case. And second, to after this point, if you can just probably highlight, Lucia, Claudia, and everyone about the positive that have emerged from this situation. Some local government probably worked fairly well and in a cooperative way with you, and also the cooperation with other organizations. You mentioned Citizen UK. Mm-hmm. I know from personal experience they do a lot of work. You mentioned Age UK and other organization, Lucia. So yeah, if you can just expand a bit on that, I think it's interesting. So yeah, Bruno first, maybe.
Happy to. Well, I think it's difficult to say that we've been able to reach all, but we certainly tried. We did our best, and I feel very proud of the work of the team in that moment. As you said, look, a word of mouth is the way that normally people find out about our service and the work we do. So I think that remained being the case, in the sense that if someone was able to reach us through WhatsApp, they would then be able to share this with their friends and families.
Yeah.
Probably not meeting them, but sending them a message, jumping on a call. So certainly the community continued to be the main, let's say, way of getting our work known by others. We did set up the whole team as well with mobile numbers. And I remember that we had a bit of an IT challenge there as we're trying to set up very fancy systems. And we realized that that wouldn't make sense to reach our community. Mm-hmm. WhatsApp was the main and best way to get our message out. So everyone had a WhatsApp number. everyone was enabled to send those messages to the service users they were engaged with. And that gave us a really good reach. We also use social media a lot, especially with information directly related to health and well-being. So all the channels that we had, they were constantly used to share information in Spanish and Portuguese. And finally, we had our website as well. And that's where we had the FAQs, both in Spanish and Portuguese. So we used everything we could, let's say. Yeah. And I think that was very successful.
I'm going to jump in there because I believe it's something that Ilmo did, along with other Latin American charities, was to also make sure that people knew how to use Zoom. And I think this is something that was tackled earlier. We talked about digital divide and Miss Claudia Lopez providing laptops. But when we think about the digital divide, it includes not having access to technological devices, but also includes your ability to use these devices. And I think what I've seen, because I was doing field work at the time during COVID, there's a lot of organizations calling people on WhatsApp, showing how to use Zoom, so that then a lot of the information that you were sharing was also through the webinars. And I remember I did a short LADPP, which is the Latin American Disabled People's Project, at a charity similar to IRMO. They asked me to create a video of how to use Zoom, and I did that. And then it was shared on by the WhatsApp.
Because we had one, so it could have been your
video. Oh my God, fantastic. But I think that was also quite key. And those webinars were so fundamental to make sure that people knew what their right to furlough at the time, or they how to register for the youth settlement scheme, and something to celebrate there.
As well. I think also what we haven't also mentioned, and it was something that we soon realised as a school. I mean, we knew the schools were going to shut down. We did a quick, survey: who has got this, who has got this, who has got this. We didn't realise actually how many families don't have internet. So that was another thing. So one, they don't have a device. Two, they don't have internet, or the internet is only on their mobile phone because that's the only device that they have or use. So how are these families going to, children accessing their lessons? They don't have the internet. It's not really great to do it on the phone. And the parents as well, because we forget about so many parents who their social life could be having their weekly English lesson. They're going to college or they're going to places like Irmoa or Lawa or Laws, and that's where they're getting that sort of support from the community. So I think that was another thing that was really noted, the lack of internet that families have access to.
That obviously didn't anything to close the gap. Digital divide got widened.
Every day it was just increasing. Really.
If anything, we became aware of the digital divide being a thing that needs to be tackled.
And obviously how, like it or not, Wi-Fi and the internet becomes increasingly primary basic good rather than a luxury kind of thing.
Yeah. One of the things we did at IRMO was we got in touch with a phone company, and they provide free SIM cards with data to charities. So until today, they keep sending us. Yes, this was very important. During COVID, when it was not possible for people to collect them, we send them by post.
At the school, like I said, so students who are looked after students, they're the priority. So they were able to get their laptops. Bearing in mind, they got their laptop towards the summer term. So, lockdown was in March, and they got their laptops, government laptops, towards the summer term. By then, we had already distributed about 200 laptops. And schools were given some laptops, but we had to fund Chromebooks for students. We had to fund SIM cards with the internet. We had not SIM cards, we had dongles. So family would come pick up their dongle, and that's how students would be able to access their education. So that's wonderful that you were given sort of SIM cards that you could distribute to the community. Mm. But schools, there was a lot of financial pressure under schools to be able to support our children, because no access to recourse to public funds. I mean, they're in school now and they're not able to have a free school meal.
Yeah.
So they are not eligible for a free school meal. So at the school, we pay for their school meal.
Yeah, something that children need to be
absolutely
taught further in the hopefully in the near future. Jasmine, coming back to you, because you led the evaluation of the health and well-being initiative by IRMO. Can you tell us what the main takeaways were and what the findings can teach us in terms of importance and impact of migrants community organizing?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the things we've even been touching upon right now, like the years of experience and the connections that people had already with the Latin American community. You, Claudia, as a teacher, would have had connections with the children, their families, Irma as well. It's something that was so important then when COVID came around, that there was someone there that they could trust, that spoke their language, that understood what their needs were. And even as needs changed, they had the communication to be able to adapt the services from a COVID well-being response to a health and well-being response even now. I think that is something, especially when we're hearing about these different examples, that information wasn't translated into Spanish, or that the provision just wasn't good enough, and that in that space, people who were experts, who knew the Latin American community, were able to actually step up and provide this, was really, really impactful.
Thank you, Jasmine. We covered quite a lot, actually. And this leads to probably our last question, in the sense that we're now in a post-COVID context, but we are facing new crises, especially the cost of living crisis. Hopefully things are going to be a bit better this year, according to one of our latest research, at least here at the National Institute. But some of the issues obviously will remain, because you know, they are linked to each other in a way. And if you want to come in the sense of what can be done to support London's Latin American community specifically, but in general migrant community organizations more broadly. And you have you, Jasmine and Domiziana, any research project coming up that goes in that direction, or maybe not, but still they're linked to migration more in general. And obviously for Claudia and Bruna and Lucia, and you know, if you have new projects, obviously you have seen, experienced the issues and therefore there is always a learning in a way from that crisis.
Well, I think it's so important to continue doing things like this, because at the end of the day, what we all want as community leaders is that recognition. And without research, social awareness, campaigning for the rights of our community, then not going to come unless we are the change and we make it happen. I think so. What we've learned, or what I've learned from the pandemic, is, you know, there are, as Bruna said, there's so many families out there that you can't reach. The beauty of the internet and social media in being able to reach these families that may yes. feel isolated in a foreign land. So I think it was an awfully dark time, but if anything, it showed a lot of positivity and resilience yes. from the community in coming together and working together. I mean, I remember I would always share Irmo's posts, and I then, you know, I would put it on my WhatsApp status, and then I'd put it on Twitter, and I'd put it anywhere that I would think that I could reach at least one person who needed that information. You know, we made flyers and we had them in the school reception, because schools weren't actually open the whole pandemic. I think people forget that schools we did not close. I feel as an educator, it has changed the young generation, the iPad generation, the phone generation, where they spent so much time at home on their social medias that they sort of did become addicted. If they weren't addicted to internet before and social media, it's a problem now with young people and mental health. I mean, we are still seeing the after effects of the pandemic and mental health on, I see it on young people every single day, the effects the pandemic had on these young people. And unfortunately, due to this lack of recognition, there is no specific support for our community. We do not have enough translators at CAMHS. Mm. CAMHS do not translate letters for Latin American parents in Spanish or Portuguese. So lots of times these appointments that these young people have, after it's so hard for us to get them onto a CAMHS waiting list anyway, mm-hmm. even up to an appointment time, that parents, they don't understand the letters. And also there's a lack of understanding in our community in general on the topic of mental health. So I think that's a lot. We need to tackle that as well. I believe we probably see it at UDMO as well.
We see that we shared those challenges naturally, Claudia. I think I would go back to the beginning of our conversation, and I would highlight the importance of the official recognition of Latin America as an ethnic group in the UK. I think that's very key. COVID showed us that in a moment of crisis, the recognition of our community can contribute a lot to positive outcomes for this community. And it also showed how in that moment there was this eagerness to do the outreach, to get people vaccinated. It was really important to engage with several communities, not only Latin Americans. I guess now we have the opportunity to try and prevent such damaging impact on those by ensuring that they have access to healthcare service, and I'll let Lucia speak about this in more detail. So that recognition is really key. So official and effective, I would say as well, so that the monitoring forms actually include Latin American there, so we can tick that box and demonstrate our needs. But I would also highlight the need to let's say, recognize the work that is done by organizations that are led by and for the communities that they represent. I think that's really key. There is really valuable knowledge, trust built in these communities for decades now, and we are able to provide culturally sensitive service, and that is really impactful. So not only us as IRMU, but us as the several wonderful organizations that are also doing that. So recognizing that specialism is really key. I think it can happen sometimes that you might have someone approaching your organization and saying that all they need is that we connect them with the community. That is just that. I would challenge the just. That's a lot. That's years of work. That's years of trust. And it should be valued. And I think that should also come in the form of funding to those that can bring that specialism to the work that they do. I would also speak about English language, employment, support for migrant workers. I think that's really key. Monitor the educational impact that COVID and all those crises have had and continue to have. And finally, my last point was mental health. But that was as you ended too.
Yeah.
So when I look back, everything we have done with not a very big team, I feel like, as Bruna said, if we have more support in the future, we can do more things. And also our work to ensure access to healthcare to migrants is very important, but we also need policies to change and to, even though, for example, primary care should be free and accessible to everyone, migrants still face issues accessing GP, being asked for proof of address. And this is not speaking about secondary care where people have to even pay or get into the because of healthcare. So I hope we can change this in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Lucia.
I want to add something here because we've heard about the policies that support Latin American organizations and leaders, but more broadly also migrant-led organizations. And I just want to make a point about what researchers can do in terms of really collaborating with communities, but doing research that is guided by the research questions that the community considers important rather than the other way around. And I think this is one of the beautiful lessons that we've learned from COVID is that there can be cooperation, there can be really productive partnerships when they're guided by the needs of the communities. And for that, you need to really speak with community leaders in terms of what research needs to be done, what research is important, and how can the research that we are paid to do serve the community. And I think this is one of the big lessons that I take away from the collaborations with Claudia, the work I've done with Latin American House over COVID.
Yes.
And I guess just also to say that ethnic recognition for us can be a first step and that national data is very important, but there is already a lot of really great evidence collected by IRMU, collected by other charities, by Domiziana, which already shows a lot of the problems that Latin Americans face, a lot of the challenges and a lot of really great solutions and suggestions on how to overcome those. So we're not starting from zero. The ethnic recognition is the first step, an important step, but we don't need it to necessarily start all these changes that we know we need. Yeah. More translators, we need to make sure that systems are understood, many more things that you're already campaigning for. And so really important to understand, also highlight the great work that's already been done and to take that forward into the future.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Domiziana, Claudia, Bruna, Lucia and Jasmine for being with us.
Thank you, Luca.
Lots of interesting and wonderful insight. Thank you for the work you do in your communities. And you can obviously read more on our website, on the research we've done on migration and other topics on nisa.ac.uk. This is all the time we had for today. Until next one, goodbye.